around saying names starting with Domio.
Domio.
Domio. Bob.
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 Myoju.
Myoju.
Frankie.
Frankie.
Jinryu.
Jinryu.
Joan.
Joan.
Jill.
Jill.
Chapel.
Chapel.
Kathy.
Kathy.
Chuketsu.
Chuketsu.
Paul.
Paul.
Richard.
Richard.
Walt.
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 Yes.
Mark.
Mark.
Ted.
Ted.
Robin.
Robin.
Sam.
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 Jeff.
Jeff.
Oh. So for announcements, we have this Saturday, the poetry group at 10 o'clock. And yeah, it's still noon. And the next Saturday, the 22nd, is the book group where they're studying Homeless Koro. And then July 13th, we have our potluck, but it's going to be in the evening at 6 o'clock at my house. And there's information on in the newsletter. There'll be this Friday again. And if anybody wants directions, I put it up in the Google Sangha thing, but if you're not a member of that, just email me and I will give you directions. So, being family, friends, it'll be a nice evening in July, you know, hopefully the weather will be nice. Yeah. And it's Drew's birthday, he said.
Birthday? Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
What was that? I missed it.
Drew, remember?
It's his birthday.
So he's coming with us.
On that evening?
Oh.
Okay.
We're
going
to have that more
today.
It's your anniversary, too.
It's my anniversary.
Yeah, and you can still register for our session August 20th through the 25th, or you can arrive. That's Tuesday through Sunday, but you can arrive Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday. And a crew of us went out to go scope it out last Saturday, the new place that we're renting. And I think we all thought it was pretty cool. First year always is a little, you know, so we did 2 years at this other facility, but we kind of outgrew it. We had 20 people, and it was kind of stuffed to the gills. I mean, the whole building probably wasn't a whole lot bigger than this building in a way. I mean, maybe with kind of a basement, but this is like a summer camp. It's a little spread out, but it's like, you know, plenty of space.
I'm not going to be able to rest until I ask, even though it's the most childish question. Is the space climate control?
It is not. It most definitely is not. But, you know, it's out in the foothills of the Coast Range, kind of a lovely wooded area. So I'm hoping that'll be a little cooler than Portland. And also the Zendo itself, I mean, I asked her if it would be cooler. And she didn't think it would necessarily be cooler than some other spaces, but it's one of those giant cavernous lodges with a cement floor, which just strikes me as like, that's gonna be a cooler place in the summertime. So,
do you remember which way it faces? Because I was thinking about the big windows.
The windows, I don't know which way they're facing. I think they might be north.
Good.
Fans,
right?
Huh?
Are we gonna bring fans?
Yeah, we have to bring fans.
You hate the fans.
So much.
I know. Well, I mean, you could fork over and get us some of those silent Dyson fans.
Sure.
We'd have them, you know, the little tower. We could just have them all throughout the Zendo.
Yes. Yeah. Put it on the list.
A fan.
Like
Magoo. That's right.
All right. So tonight I have been extremely busy, so I just figured I'd go right back to this book. It has led to some great conversations, so. This chapter is by Carolyn Joshin Atkinson. She's in the Kobun Chino Odagawa Roshi lineage, and she's head teacher at Everyday Dharma Zen Center in Santa Cruz, California. So this is accepting our lives in difficult times. It's a big challenge to really pay attention directly to how we are living in and with the world, especially in difficult or painful times. It's an important choice that we make to turn in the direction of peacefulness when life can be difficult, to cultivate the Buddhist practices of mindfulness, of equanimity, and of ethical behavior, when it might be easier to turn toward resistance to life as it is. We try to bring our best awareness to all of these issues. And usually we notice that we feel fine about the places in our lives that are comfortable, but we tend to feel stuck in the places we don't like. This is not really a surprise, of course, but it is a challenge. I find that I want even to approach, find that if I want even to approach choosing my peacefulness in my life, I have to be willing to look at the question of acceptance. And of course, the only place where acceptance is an issue for me is where I do not want things to be the way they are. I can accept that the sun is shining and that I'm physically able to come to our Zen Center for meetings. I have no trouble accepting that I have people, so many people in my life that I love. Accepting any of these things is no problem. But the places where my mind is disturbed or resisting, or where my heart is closed down, these feelings are, of course, exactly what I don't want to accept. I would rather not acknowledge such responses. This is where I do not want to be open to life as it is. I know that for many of us, there are circumstances in our lives that bring up huge feelings of grief, of guilt perhaps, of shame, of injury, of anger, or despair. One person said to me recently, "I can't seem to resolve my feelings of guilt about my life and what I've done. I know I need to accept that this is the way it is, but I'm finding it almost impossible to do." Another person asked this, "What do I do with all of my negative feelings toward myself and others? I recognize my situation, but I feel so much anguish about what others did to me. I can't seem to let go of the injury and of wanting things to be different than they are." Haven't we all felt like this at times in our lives? We're talking here about deep acceptance. And acceptance is a difficult task, a demanding undertaking. Sometimes the challenge of acceptance feels impossible. So then she tells a story about a man she grew up with, so he started out a boy, and he was pretty, she said he was pretty unnoticeable, but he had this younger brother. So the guy that we're talking about is Andy, and he had his younger brother is Davey. And Andy ended up, as they started going to school together, Andy was really protective of Davey and would get in fights to protect him and in trouble and whatever. And she found out later that their parents were both alcoholics and the boys were basically fending for themselves. So Andy was really looking out for his younger brother. And then Andy went off to college, graduated. This was during the Vietnam War, and so he was, facing perhaps being drafted, and he found various, loopholes and ways to put that off until finally he was 26 and aged out of the draft. But, they watched students being shot at Kent State in Ohio, and that she said he was filled with rage at this. He joined Students for a Democratic Society. He poured animal blood on draft cards. He went to sit-ins. He got arrested repeatedly. But then he aged out of the draft. But his brother did not. And so his brother ends up going to Vietnam and getting killed. So she said that these stories were common during those chaotic times. And after Davy was killed, Andy just basically went crazy. So he entered just a world of rage and despair and addiction and whatever. Then she said, recently, when I returned to my hometown, I ran into Andy, quite by chance, as I was walking down the street. And they recognize each other and catch up a little bit. And she talks about how he's found a measure of peace in his life, basically by accepting the past, accepting the, you know, his early life, his parents, all of it. Andy was asking difficult questions of himself and his life. What do I need to accept? And what do I need to give up? Reflecting back on our conversation, I've come up with a tentative list of possible things we might need to accept if we really want to choose peacefulness in our lives. Here's a list, partial, I'm sure, of what we might need to come to terms with. One, we might need to accept that people we have truly loved have caused pain for us. We might need to accept that what we think we know to be true may not be so for someone else. And she goes into a little more detail about all of this if you want to read the chapter. Three, we might need to accept that often we don't know a lot. We don't know what's going to happen, or what is happening, or what did happen. Simply put, often we don't really know what's going on. Four, we might need to accept that being the injured party in a situation does not actually confer any special privileges upon us. Being injured doesn't automatically make us good. Five, we might need to accept that we cannot do everything we think we should or be everything we want in our lives. We might need to accept that actually we are ordinary, so very ordinary, all of us. And six, as long as we're really looking at the nature of life, we need to accept several other demanding teachings of the Buddha. No matter how much we love or want or fear, we cannot hold on to anything. So she talks about acceptance being a choice, practice being a choice, that, you know, all of these things, for instance, in this guy's life that happened to him, he didn't have a lot of or any say in. But he could choose what his response would be. When times are difficult, which means for many of us much of the time, the question arises, how do we respond? And as I read this, I would encourage you to think beyond just the circumstances of your own life, because a lot of times, you know, maybe your life is okay right now, fine, peaceful, fortunate, but if you think in a broader sense of like all the suffering that's going on in the world, that is very difficult to accept. What are we to do with our experiences living in these difficult days and weeks and years? Why can't things be better? Do we have to give up, as someone suggested, all hope of a better past? This is important. How do we relate to the painful events in our lives? We actually don't get to choose what has happened in the past or what is happening in the world beyond our own minds. We don't get to choose what feelings may arise within us in living our lives. However, we do get to choose how we respond to these feelings and to life itself. And this can sometimes be quite difficult. As Andy said to me, my life has been what it is, not what I wanted it to be. And I'm making my peace with that, and it hasn't been easy. And then as she's talking about acceptance is not, she wants to be clear because sometimes people get confused, acceptance is not condoning injury or cruelty or thoughtlessness. It's not dismissiveness of our feelings. she recalls the Sufi expression, trust in God, but tie up your camel. Acceptance doesn't mean that your camel may not wander away in the desert or be taken by someone else. Acceptance is not the same as self-pity or self-justification. So she says, the question I'm posing is this. What do we each need to accept if we want to have a quiet mind and an open heart? Or maybe it's the question, what do we need to give up wanting to have in order to find peacefulness? What price are we asked to pay? I would suggest that nothing is free in this life. Acceptance and equanimity come at a price. Peacefulness demands a great deal from us. Nothing is free. So again, what price are we willing to pay for a quiet mind and an open heart? How are we going to cultivate quietness and a peace of mind? Sometimes I find myself remembering a fragment of writing from a man named Raymond Carver. He was someone who experienced a difficult life partly due to a number of circumstances beyond his control, as well as to his own choices. And with all these issues, he was finally able to come to a place of stability in his own mind and heart. In the months before he died, he wrote this line. And did you get what you wanted from this life? Even so. I think of his question, and I notice that my mind stops on the words, even so. It seems to me that this speaks directly to all of us, whatever our circumstances. Are we getting what we want from this life? Even so? When I ask this question of myself, I realize that what I want to get from this life is to embrace peacefulness, to choose peacefulness, even in times of difficulty, even in times of war. Even so. I suppose you can say that also, just even about your own behavior, not just about kind of what's happening externally, but yeah, okay. Sometimes I got into it with somebody or got all wrapped up in a struggle or resentment or something. That's something that happened. Okay.
I can hear the acceptance in that, in his last words. Whereas I can relate to the picking. You know, I'm picking, I'm not accepting. Mm-hmm. Well, if it was, if I only cash, why didn't, you know? It's painful.
I don't pick much at the past, but I must admit, sometimes when I do look back, I go, I'm glad I got through that. Glad I got over it. We are young and foolish and inexperienced at part of our lives. And sometimes it makes for uncomfortable memories. Mm. If you remember that you are moved on and that there's other people young around you that may be making those same mistakes, you have a certain amount of compassion for them.
To accept that people we have truly loved have caused pain for us, that what we think we know to be true may not be so for some, for everyone else. Often we don't know a lot. Being the injured party does not actually confer any special privileges. We cannot do everything we think we should, or be everything we want.
There's a picture I used to have in my role of Fall of Icarus, and as Icarus I was getting close to the sun, it was falling into the sea, and the boat was going on, and the farmer kept plowing, and the dog kept barking, and the, you know, all that stuff. And I wanted to look through the museum that I was hanging in, wrote a poem about it. And it's always struck me because it's hard to know that the world just keeps going on, despite everything that's happening to me personally or to everything else. We're just, people are suffering at this moment in camps and dying and trying to come up with a Guatemala. Just makes you, you know, when you realize, and then you go out and you still live your life and you still do things that other people do it. And so, I don't know, it's hard to explain, it's like a reckoning. You have to just accept that, that that's the way the flow of life seems to be. People just keep going. We all do that, I guess. Just opening to that, that, I don't know, it's even hard to talk about.
I found this this practice of acceptance to be very, very difficult and challenging, but also significant. And I guess for me, a lot of times it's been about ideals. It's been, you know, I have a idealistic, ambitious nature, and I believe the world can be a better place. Damn it. You know, like, no excuses. Like, we can do better, and we should keep on trying to do better until the very end. Like, and it's hard to I don't want to give up that conviction. But on the other hand, it's very easy to get attached to those ideals and just, you know, resist the way things are, how very little you can actually manage to do, the likelihood that things are not going to change nearly as fast as I would love to see them change, you know.
Yeah, she asks what you have to give up, and the thought that popped into my head immediately was, in a very weird way, you have to give up justice.
Hmm.
Your demand for redress, right?
That balance between accepting and condoning, that's really hard for me.
Yeah.
To accept something without condoning.
Mm-hmm.
yeah, this is okay, this is the way it should be.
Right. I guess, I mean, for me, I think of it as, and I don't know, this might be a limited way to look at it, but I think of acceptance as being about the past and now, not about what comes next. Like, here we are, this happened. Like, what was your phrase?
That sure was a thing that happened.
That sure was a thing that, you know, here we are. But accept, condoning feels like, therefore, all right, whatever happens, like it's giving up responsibility for the future. Whereas I feel like we can accept here and now, and therefore all the things that have brought us here, and not take it further than that. I don't know. Does that ring a bell?
Accept something in the world. But at the same time, work to change it. Yes, I know that's part of the world, and it's a possibility that this bad thing can happen to me, can happen to someone I love. And I accept that that's a possibility. And I don't fret, I don't worry. But at the same time, I think that I can take these actions in the future that would lessen that possibility. This is drunk driving. I mean, yeah. You got alcohol, you got car. You're going to have drunk drivers, you're going to have people killed by it. And in this one way, you can accept that without fretting, without worrying, without worrying about the past and the people you've lost in that. But at the same time, stepping forward and saying, I'm going to donate money from that. I'm going to go ahead and do this. I'm going to teach my children this. So you can accept the fact that something's in the world at the same time working to change it.
And in a way, I mean, I'm guessing that people have this experience or have witnessed it in others, that the people who are most effective at working for change are doing so from a fairly centered and realistic point of view of where they're, whereas, you know, it'd be difficult in many cases to work in justice or for change and not be just like, this is so wrong, this is just so wrong, this just shouldn't be. And that's just an extra, and not peacefulness, as she would put it.
When you talk about justice, though, that kind of gets back to what you know and what you don't know, mm-hmm. or what you think you know, mm-hmm. or what, you know, it's, you think it's justice. I mean, that's why you said give up justice. It's like, it's justice. Mm-hmm. That's because you feel it should be this way, yeah. or that way.
Justice is always.
So that kind of goes back to what she said about what you know and what you don't, what you think you know.
It always is true, though, like I've been saying. I mean, that's a. I know we can use our spiritual practice to just make ourselves feel better and. Then we just don't have to take any action. That's not what we want to do, but yeah, and in a way we can only know for ourselves what the state of our own hearts are. Are we letting ourselves off the hook too easily? Are we just, you know, spiritually bypassing? Or, you know, I don't know, like Thich Nhat Hanh said something about, I wish, I don't have the exact quote, but in an interview, he said something about the value of coming to terms with the fact that our civilization may destroy itself. That to really, and, you know, which in a way is like, Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, like, let's see, But of course, I mean, you know, somebody like Thich Nhat Hanh is not saying, so, oh well, you know, we might as well not, you know, keep moving forward or increasing or decreasing fossil fuel use, because, you know, that's not what he's saying at all. But to come to terms with that somehow within ourselves.
I think about that a lot, and I been through this training over the last few years on being with dying that also included the systems component that was a really hard look at what's happening on our planet. And to me, the being with dying piece really applied to how I started thinking about climate change and human life on the planet, and that if somebody I love has a potentially terminal illness, I want to keep actively giving them the treatment, and at the same time I try to be mindful of the quality of the days and the times we have together. And I think about that. To me, it kind of helps me hold that what's a really challenging space for me with coming to terms with that.
I think also coming to terms with it, which I don't know that I have, makes for a more compassionate, loving person. If we have come to terms with this, I mean, our outlook would really change. We'd have more, I would have more sense of kindness and gentleness and sadness, yes, but just more compassion for life. The struggles in life.
Making me think of a, I think it was kind of a, I don't know if it was just exactly nonviolent communication, but it was some kind of advice for how to deal with conflict, which I definitely have not mastered. But it talked about going into a situation and with an open, you know, saying what your needs are, but with an open mind about how they might be met, which I realized, generally when I'm going to in that space, I know what needs to happen and stop happening. Like, you know, so I realized that's very, you know, it's just gonna cause conflict when you go into a situation like that, as opposed to, I don't know, that kind of stable confidence that isn't going to just, you know, give up, but it's going to say, this is, you know, what I need. I see what you're saying. Like, and actually have the other person, the other parties be part of that. Quite something to aspire to in any way, but it seems like that kind of comes from another place of acceptance, like accepting this person may not agree with me, they may not have the same experience as me, here's a situation, there's some kind of conflict.
But if you're able to do that, you can hear things so much differently. You hear a totally different message.
Yeah. I don't know how many of you are here on Sunday, but Cation, Diana Briggs, was here, and she was talking about love and acceptance, and then particularly around this story of she was the primary caregiver for her beloved husband of almost 50 years. He had Alzheimer's, and so she was with him for the last several years. And she said she came up with this little ritual for transforming grief into joy. And so she told everybody about it. She said, you know, at some point in the day, maybe in the morning after your meditation or before your meditation, you know, you call to mind the being, or in this case, I'm also thinking of, like, could this apply to the planet? you know, to civilization, whatever, and to that you call to mind this being and this sense of loss and grief, and first of all to call to mind gratitude if it's a person for all the time that you have had, or if they're dying but they're still around what you still have together, or you know, in terms of the planet, what we still enjoy, what we still benefit from. So there's the gratitude, and then she said blessing. So that if it's a departed person, you wish them well and send them on their way in a way. And I don't know, I wonder if that would... And she just said over time, it just... The grief doesn't leave, but it's you have a different relationship to it. It changes that focus. And I don't know if, you know, probably not the only one that... I don't know, I'm kind of morbid in this way, but I pretty frequently call to mind how I'm going to lose everything. All my loved ones and everything that I have and... You know, and you know, on the one hand, that can fill you with a lot of panic, and like, you know, and kind of a sense of vulnerability about being so attached to all of it. And it's, but in a way, that's like that's a particular focus that takes you out of this moment, you know, out of the appreciation for like, you know, my house is still standing. My husband is still with me. My dogs are still happy and healthy. Just today. I mean, just to be grateful for that being so today. And why that's not cheapened by the fact that it might change tomorrow. Matter of fact, then we should be even more appreciative that it's what we have today. It's amazing how I feel like that's like the I don't know, probably different days I'll tell you different things, but if I had to summarize Buddhism to somebody who just completely unfamiliar with it, I would just say your experience of the world depends in a large part on the state of your own mind, or entirely on the state of your own mind, but that sounds a little extreme.
I don't know if anyone read The How of Happiness. It's this awesome book that shows you scientific, their methods. I think it's like at UC Berkeley, maybe? It's like the Happiness Institute or something. Like they try to promote happiness, and they she gives outlines like different techniques that you can do to improve happiness. And so one of those is like a gratitude journal, mm-hmm. or and so I've been doing that for the past 3 or 4 years, just writing 5 simple things that I'm grateful for every day, and that has drastically changed my perspective. Mm. Just focusing, because then throughout the day, I'm going, oh, I'm going to write that down. I'm going to write that one down. So I'm noticing all the good things and things that I appreciate. But there's another woman who studies psychology, and she's on like a TED Talk, and it was like how to not get stuck in the negatives, and how she studied how like you can get really focused on the negatives, and that usually has a longer lasting effect than the positives. Mm-hmm. So she said that you can do the gratitude journal, but also even just talking about it with other people. Mm-hmm. So like in our family, we try to do like what's our favorite part of the day. So every day we say, mm-hmm. usually what are our favorite people, and then my little one will always like forget someone's name at the table, like Grace or something, you know, one of my other daughters, and then we'll go, oh, what about Grace? Anyway. So, and then we all laugh, and then we share our favorite part of the day and go over that. So it's just a really nice way, I don't know, it definitely has shifted my viewing things. Plus, I have this like great journal of all these little memories that I can kind of go back to and smile and laugh. But that's a great book. I don't know if anyone else has ever. I mean, there's all these like when Jeff did his when you talk and you had us write thank someone. That's like one of the things you can do. Like thank someone who has been part of your life, which I still haven't done. I want to compose this great. That's the ideal. I want to compose this great writing thing, and I just never sit down to do it. Or I should just write a little thing. But there's some amazing little things you can do. Forgiveness is one. Forgive someone that you haven't forgiven.
It just occurred to me, this kind of defies the whole purpose, but I wonder what it would be like if you also wrote down five things that you're struggling to accept. Which, I mean, that doesn't do the whole, like, rebuild the positive thing, but I'm just kind of thinking of how maybe if you kind of put it down, and then especially if you looked back and realized the things that were really bugging you, and then kind of like, really, you know, like, because we're just, you know, we're just kind of perseverating on these worries and these concerns and like whatever, and if you put them down in that objective way, I wonder how they would look.
I just think it's so wonderful that you're doing that with such a young family—a 2-year-old, 3-year-old, and a 4-year-old.
Yeah, try.
What a gift for them.
Oh, thanks. Gift that they're here with me.
Yeah,
I'm happy.
Thoughts about acceptance and how hard it is. Like, what do you have to give up? What do you have to give up wanting? To give up wanting to finish everything.
Well, somewhere in there, it's hard because we have a limited view of ourselves. We don't really see ourselves completely. I mean, oftentimes we don't see our faults or our negative aspects of our, mm-hmm. who we are, and that might make it hard to give things up.
Well, I mean, but there's different aspects of practice that help bring those things to light for us.
Mm-hmm.
Sangha, working with the precepts,
mm-hmm.
you know, that kind of, I don't know, I feel like, I think my family probably thinks I'm crazy. Because, you know, I'm pretty determined to, like, open the closet of my mind and drag any skeletons out that I can find and somehow deal with them and get rid of them. And I think that kind of common sense in this culture is just like, just don't, just leave them in there. Just, you know, if you're getting away with it, like, everybody's got them in there. I mean, I do. I think my sister thinks I'm, like, a, you know, like, kind of obsessive. And perfectionistic or something like that in wanting to see these things and take account responsibility for them. But to me, because every one of them that's in there, I don't know, it feels like it keeps you cut off from the world somehow.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just ignore them, that they really do. They really do keep us down. And then when you can't get rid of the skeleton, then you have to learn to accept it. You have to learn to accept it. you know, I guess like the guest house, like, yeah, this is my, this is my, this is my irritability skeleton.
I'm really trying to work on not trying to do so much. Like, I feel like I have to, like, get all these things done and my agenda and my checklist, and I'm trying to, like, drop it, but that's, like, the acceptance of, like, I'm ordinary. I cannot get all these things done. I'm, you know, take my time and try to be present instead of, you know, I'm just such a doer. Get this done, check it off. Like my husband always laughs because I'm, like, before we have to go somewhere, I'm like, well, I'll just vacuum this real quick. And he's like, why are you vacuuming? Like, this is, we've got to go in like 5 minutes. You think we're going to vacuum in 5 minutes? And I'm like, I can get it done. Like, it's like a, I don't know, this. So I'm trying to, that's my, and I'm trying to work on, it's just like, let that go.
But then everything, really but then everything, like, is completely out of control.
It does. That's how I feel sometimes. It's really a struggle for me.
I, you know, everybody has their different attachments and strengths, but I have to say that when I visit somebody who just, their life is kind of chaos, but they seem content in the middle of it. Like their house is kind of a mess, you know. Not a complete pigsty, but kind of piles of stuff everywhere. And they're just like, oh, excuse me, I'll move that so you can sit down, you know. Like, and I just like, wow. I think that's just like a superpower, you know. That's amazing.
Oh my gosh. Like, I'm that person, and I'm just like, oh my gosh, I should be one of those people that doesn't have the piles. Like, I need to be somebody who can accept that you have to do boring, menial stuff on a repeat basis. Like, that's what being a grown up is. And that's what it takes, and have a good house. Yeah. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Come over to my house and I'll accept your workaholic need.
Do you know where it is? For the most part?
I can mostly get to what I need to
get. You're organized. It's just a fluid sort of organization. I mean, I have known people like that. You know, if you clean up their mess, they can't function because they know where
everything is. I would lose my mind if you touched my stuff.
So is there anything else that people would be willing to share that they have to accept or they have to give up wanting to be different in order to have peace?
I have to give up feeling like I'm in control of the outcome, that I know what's going to happen. That's hard for me. I want to know what's going to happen. And I know in one way that's unknowable.
Do you find yourself needing to know that, like, before you make a decision or before you go forward in something? Yeah, like we can know.
If I want to address some conflict I have with someone, I'm afraid to even go there unless I know how they're going to respond.
And that is such an unpredictable realm. That is all bets are off. All bets are off, realm. Yeah, I think that's probably part of my conflict avoidance too, because you don't know what's going to happen when you go into that territory.
Personality test that's sort of an alternative to the Myers-Briggs called the Big Five personality test. And it said something surprising and not surprising about me having a high neuroticism quotient. So I had to go read up on neuroticism, you know, what's underneath the pop psych definition. And I'm struggling to accept that. I'm not wired for certainty. Certainty is an extreme rarity in my life. There's a certain existential fear underneath that lack of certainty. And that even though I've always kind of, I've been conditioned to kind of regard that lack of certainty and that tendency to overthink things as a weakness, they are, it is just a tendency, it is just a, it is just a force in my life. And if you're willing to look at it like that, that tendency to sort of fuss and overthink things is actually the expression of a profound protective instinct. A very deep-seated desire to take care of things. Next will be trying to figure out how to accept that curiosity is not always a strength, since that's another thing the test called out. But that's been an interesting process, is deconstructing that image of self as being, you know, a little bit wimpy and weak-willed, because I don't have a lot of certainty. And it's hard to bring a lot of power to bear when you lack certainty. I'm just, I don't know how to turn that off. And hey, it pays off sometimes. I quite often think of things because I'm worrying about them in front of other people.
Is there a measure of peacefulness that comes from maybe just accepting this instead of thinking it needs to go away?
Well, and it throws a light backwards on the assumption that you're not supposed to be like that. Right? That's a negative. That's very useful.
All right, well.